This is the final episode of the 4-episode series with Yara. In this episode, we will be talking about the APA, dealing with discrimination and racial problems, and talking about an exploitive class.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely agreed. So, for the next question, we will be talking a bit about something that I found on your website, which is the APA newsletter. So, do you mind describing? I know this is like totally a different question from what we just totally talked about, but I'm just very interested in it. So can you describe what the newsletter does and what it is?
Yeah, I mean, it's actually not so disconnected, but we'll come back to that. So the APA is the American Philosophical Association, and it's like the umbrella association for professional philosophers and also other philosophers in North America. The APA has a bunch of different committees that deal with specific parts of the profession. And some of those committees deal with like, or have their task is like to do with particular minority groups. So I'm part of the APA Committee on Asian and Asian American Philosophers and Philosophies, which is a big mouthful. But basically the committee does a bunch of things. The newsletter that you mentioned is one of those. We release a newsletter every 6 months. And the newsletter will concern a particular theme or a particular issue to do with Asian philosophy. So, you know, like traditional Asian traditions like Confucianism, Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, etc. Or what Asian American philosophers are doing, you know, in philosophy right now.
Yaron is a part of the APA, which stands for the American Philosophical Association. It is an umbrella association for philosophers. In North America, there are numerous committees. The APA newsletter is one of the things that they do.
So I started doing this a couple of years ago in the middle of the pandemic, and the committee had previously focused a lot on Asian philosophies and bringing them into dialogue with, you know, contemporary Anglo-American philosophy. And I and some other people on the committee thought, oh, well, you know, that leaves kind of untouched the other part of our ambit, which is Asian, Asian American philosophers. So the first issue that I helped to edit was an issue on the theme of what is it like to be a philosopher of Asian descent? And we asked a bunch of, you know, Asian, Asian American philosophers who work in North America and Europe and around the world to send in short 2,000, 3,000 word kind of like biographical reflections on their life, on their philosophy, on how they came to philosophy, on what it's like to be a philosopher who identifies as Asian or Asian American in this time.
Now, submissions aren't totally open to anyone. It's up to the editors to decide.
And given that we did this in 2020, both with the side of the pandemic and the anti-Asian violence that occurred because of the pandemic, it seemed like this very poignant thing to release, this kind of sociological document of these people's reflections on what it was like to be an Asian or Asian American philosopher in our present moment. So that's kind of some of the things that we do as part of the APA newsletter. And it's freely available on the internet. Steve, I'm sure you can put the link up on the podcast or whatever. Other things that we've done include more strictly like philosophical issues. So we have just released a special issue on Japanese aesthetics, looking at the long traditions of Japanese like aesthetic practices. So not only artworks and sculptures and paintings and poems, but also contemporary Japanese practices like anime and manga, Japanese movies, and also Japanese like physical practices like martial arts and dance and the tea ceremony and so on. I don't know. Do you have any other?
Yeah. Are the submissions open to anyone?
So we generally, and this is kind of up to the editors. For the last few issues, we have invited people to contribute. I think, like, yeah, there could be issues depending on how the editors choose to structure it in the future, because my term is coming to an end, where there would be open submissions on a theme. And I mean, if you had suggestions for things, maybe issues that are more focused towards a more public audience, I mean, that's something which comes to my mind now that could be really, really cool.
Yeah, that sounds interesting. I've been looking for newsletters or like publication sites or, you know, those journals where I can try like funneling in some of the stuff I've learned and also the research I've conducted into it. But obviously, like with those types of things, it's not really that easy to say. You have to do a ton of work to even get a manuscript out. So I was just very curious about the APA newsletter because it was difficult for me to totally understand what it really was. When I went on the website, it was kind of hard. But now that you told me, it makes more sense.
Yeah, so because it's part of the APA, the American Philosophical Association, it is aimed more at professional philosophers and academic philosophers. There are a lot of journals, or at least some journals and newsletters and things like that are either undergraduate focused or public focused, or even high school focused. So I've done, I had a chat with another high school student actually, who's involved in this thing called Dialexicon. And Dialexicon run a high school philosophy journal. So you or your readers could submit to Dialexicon. It's Dialexicon. Yeah, and if you wanted to, you know, like write up something drawing on the, you know, the conversations and the work that you've done with the podcast, that might be a venue to make it, you know, more widely accessible.
Yeah, I saw their podcast episode with you prior to this.
Oh, actually. Okay.
Yeah, so I checked their website out. They have a really nice journal, and the website is very well made. I did check a lot of his episodes too. I think it was really good, and I will probably send some works that I've done to it and see if I can get it published in their next journal. We'll see. And you did mention that with this one student that you talked to, they were mentioning how philosophy helped them deal with discrimination and like the suffering. And then you mentioned too how what philosophy means to you, the first part is how to deal with the suffering and pain. So yeah. Can you explain to me how we or everybody that listens to this podcast can deal with discrimination and pain?
I mean, that's obviously a very big question, and it's going to vary both person to person and also the kind of discrimination or kind of suffering that individuals are facing and their particular situation. But where philosophy can help is in kind of helping you understand the causes of your suffering. And when you can understand it, you can either work to change it, or it can like help you kind of cope with it a little better, even if you can't change things yourself, right? So a lot of my research focuses on race and racism, on the histories of racism, the different forms that it takes, the way that it shapes the ways in which people think and feel. And the goal there is both like individuals, to help individuals like understand where these forces in society come from, the connections, for example, between racism and the capitalist society in which we live, which is, you know, so many, just a bit of a detour, many theorists and many philosophers theorize what's known as racial capitalism, which is the idea that capitalism, which is the economic and social system where things are produced for profit and where people's labor, their labor power, gets exploited by other people to produce those things for profit. So capitalism separates people from their labor power, and in doing so, both makes profit for other people and kind of like, you know, in exploiting workers makes them suffer in particular ways. And theorists who think about racial capitalism argue that capitalism has been racialized since its inception. That one of the ways in which capitalism exploits people, and one of the ways in which capitalism continues to make profit through exploitation, is to draw differentiations between different racial groups. So the kinds of exclusions and discriminations that people face, people of different racialized groups face, is a kind of historical legacy of this process of exploiting people for money and profit.
Oh, that's very interesting. I've never actually understood capitalism in that way. Is there like anything else that they use to back up like this theory?
Yeah, so people go about theorizing this in a number of ways. There are historians who work on the history of racial capitalism. So they might look, for example, at, the ways in which immigrant labor in the history of the United States, for example, has been racialized for the purposes of profit. So, slavery, at least ostensibly, ended after the Civil War, and that meant that black slaves weren't easily available as a source of kind of like cheap labor. So if capitalism depends on like an exploitable class, and slaves are no longer easily that exploitable class, then capitalism has to look for other sources of cheap labor. And it's exactly at that same time in the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s that we see a huge influx of Asian so-called coolie labor, immigrant labor, on terms that enable the exploitation of those immigrants for the purposes of making profit.
Yeah, I remember learning about the Asian immigration, but more so it was them coming to the U.S. or to other U.S.-owned lands under the contract that they would work so that they could live there. And it isn't really coerced labor, but it's been like this certain form of labor that's been used consistently. And it kind of grew again once these Asian workers needed work outside of Asia. And that labor like grew again. And most of them were corrupt in a way where, yes, they would give you a document to read, but sometimes it would include wording that would be deceptive, or they would give you a document and you would work for a certain time, but that time was either not very good for you, and most of the time they would overwork you in that time period. But I'm pretty sure, and I'm not totally sure, I'm not like 100% sure, so I'm like 80% sure that some of them did let like the people out, but most of it was indeed very not as good as like a lot of people see it as.
Yeah, and even where it wasn't like deceptive or coerced, it can still be exploitative. So think about immigrant labor in the US now. Sure, there's a minimum wage, but there are all sorts of jobs where you, and like the minimum wage is horrible, we all know this, but there are all sorts of jobs where you don't even need to get paid minimum wage, or even you're not in a position to demand a minimum wage. So say that you're undocumented, and who are undocumented groups? Well, they're people who are racialized a certain way. They can't demand the kinds of protections that American citizens can, but yet their labor is necessary for our current society to exist. Like, where would we be without cleaners? Where would we be without taxi drivers? Where would we be without underpaid restaurant workers?
Yeah.
Americans, by and large, don't want to take those jobs, but someone needs to. And so we need to have an exploitable class, namely undocumented racialized workers, to carry out that work for cheap.
Now, would you say like there is a philosophy surrounding the idea that for like a society to function, or for a society to be like developed, you would have to have an exploitative class inside that society?
Yeah, so that's a big theme in many philosophies that look at, like political philosophies that look at the history of labor, the history of states, and how like states and societies need to function. More specifically, so going back to your initial question about like how philosophy can help people understand the discrimination they face, like a lot of us have to work in these underpaid, exploited jobs, and we can't leave because we need the money. And in working those jobs, we're subject to, say we work in retail, we're subject to all sorts of discrimination from customers. We can't tell them the customers are wrong because the customer is always right somehow in this country. And all of that is in this kind of like deep way caused by the structure of society, this need that society has for some people to make profit off the backs of others. It's not as if understanding this like fixes the problem, but it might help people kind of like organizing workplaces, because you can now go to your colleagues and say, hey, like we're all exploited. What can we do to change that? So there can be like political ways in which people can get together to act collectively, to organize, to try and change things. And there can also be like individual ways in which the understanding like helps you become more resilient, to understand that it's not you that's the problem, it's society and the way it's like structured.
So in this case, it's like accepting where you are and accepting how the society treats you and being comfortable with that idea, and then using that idea to further like influence your actions later or influence your thoughts later.
Yeah, I might use the word accepting. I might say understanding your place and how society is structured and your role and everyone else's role in it. But I don't think you should accept that. I think you should try and change that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But changing it, in order to change it, you need to understand it. And that's where philosophy can come in giving you that kind of understanding.
I see. Yeah, that makes more sense. I think accepting was kind of like too much of like ignoring the whole thing and just dealing with it. And I think that even when sometimes you think about that, you do have thoughts where it's kind of like that I really have no other way for me to get myself out of here. Yeah. Is that also a bad way to think about it? Or do you think that's also part of the process to better understanding?
I mean, I think sometimes that, I don't want to say it's a bad way, because in many respects, it's like an accurate, a true way to think about it. Like you by yourself can't change the whole system. And sometimes you have to suck it up because, you know, say you have a family, say you have a certain need for money right now, and you need to work this underpaid job. So I'm not suggesting that like, you know, everyone must like take up arms and try and change the system. But I do think that philosophy can help us like motivate that kind of political action. And if enough people do it, then maybe things will change. And we see this now with like climate change, for instance. You know, young people everywhere across the world are banding together, organizing, are acting to try and force corporations, governments, their fellow citizens to act differently, to change the structures that, you know, determine, like are going to lead to apocalypse, in your words previously. So those young people are, in a sense, doing practically what we're talking about now. They've got some understanding of their situation, and they're working and acting on the basis of that understanding. And that's all philosophy is, really.
I see. So they're kind of like all adopting some philosophy to extent without really knowing.
Yeah, I mean, some of them do know. Some of them have a very explicit philosophy, right? And there's also all sorts of philosophy involved in what kind of action is appropriate, what kind of action will be effective. So, you know, the, Extinction Rebellion people, for instance, they're engaged in civil disobedience and other kinds of direct political action. And there's a whole tradition of many traditions of philosophy that think about civil disobedience, that think about direct action, about when it's appropriate, when it's effective, what like the forms that it should take. So philosophy, again, can kind of like help people think about the action that they should take.